So what I would like to do today is to give you a little bit of a feeling what influenza viruses are and what the diseases which are caused, or the disease which is caused by influenza viruses. And just a little bit of definition, a pandemic is a global epidemic. And I will sort of end up, let me first start with what I'm starting with, is concentrating on the 1918 influenza, because that's sort of the mother of all pandemics, really, and then sort of go along and also end up with the new swine H1N1 influenza virus and give you a feeling what's going on with that, why it is called a pandemic, or why it may be actually wrongly called a pandemic, etc. Okay, so now, the virus is an RNA virus, yeah? So it has its genetic information, RNA, not DNA. Okay, so there are other viruses, such as, for example, a DNA virus, herpes, for example. Herpes viruses are DNA viruses. Influenza viruses, measles viruses, even HIV, they are viruses which have RNA as their genetic information. And in the case of influenza viruses, we have actually 8 different RNA segments. And if you look at this, so this is an electron micrograph of one influenza virus particle with one RNA in the center, and then there are 7 RNAs on the outside. Okay, so there are 8 mini chromosomes, so to speak, which are sort of assembled in one virus particle. Now, does anyone have a feeling how big would a cell be which would be infected by this one single virus particle? So I blow up. So this is obviously a magnified version of one influenza virus particle. How big would a cell be relative to that virus particle?
Enormous.
How? Give me a. Say it again.
100 times bigger.
Okay, we have to talk about really the Empire State Building here, in terms of relation, or even probably 2 Empire State Buildings, and you have to sort of assume that, envision that one of these virus particles infects the upper left corner of this 2X Empire State Building, and within 8 hours, the Empire State Building, the cell is killed, and about 100,000 to a million new virus particles have been formed, okay? So that is what we call a lytic virus, very, very effective in terms of turning around what the host cell is doing, okay? Now, this is... Dr. Silverstein already mentioned that we are dealing with an influenza in terms of a seasonal burden, so that's a regular influenza. We are not talking about a pandemic. We are not talking about the swine influenza. So this is just a regular seasonal influenza virus. Here are the numbers globally. In the U.S., really more than 30X. It varies a little bit. Some years are worse than others. A lot of hospitalizations per year, a lot of economic costs, and then, as also Dr. Silverstein has mentioned, there's always the threat of a pandemic influenza virus. Now, if we talk about human influenza viruses, they are sort of constantly changing, and that's sort of the hallmark. If you talk about measles, for example, that really stays the same. Influenza constantly changes. And so if you look at the different influenza viruses which have circulated the last century, 1918 is sort of the, I don't want to say bottom line, but the sort of the worst in recorded history in terms of influenza virus pandemics, and I will talk much more about this. Then we have no virus from that period, but we have some sequences, and we actually made the virus in the laboratory, and I will talk about that briefly. 1933, the first human influenza virus was isolated, and it had a hemagglutinin of the serotype 1. So this is sort of the outside of the virus here is consisting of 2 major proteins. One is called hemagglutinin. It's responsible for hemagglutination of red blood cells, and neuraminidase, which is the second protein. The most important, however, is really the hemagglutinin, and that defines what that virus is. So that's the outside of the virus, which is recognized by our immune system. And H1 viruses have been circulating since 1918, in essence, and they were replaced in 1957 by an H2 virus, a different influenza virus. Basically, one of these chromosomes was exchanged, which we saw before, with an H2 hemagglutinin, 11 years of H2, and then we had another pandemic in 1968, and the older ones, so there are no older ones around here, except Sam and me, that's referred to as Asian flu, and this was the Hong Kong flu, okay? So these are the names where the viruses just appeared the first time. And in each case, a different hemagglutinin appeared on the virus. Strangely enough, in 1977, again H1 viruses reappeared, and now we have, in 2009, we have both H1 and H3 viruses circulating, and to make sort of the entire picture, we also have influenza B viruses. So these are really different ones, but also important ones, so that we have in basically at this particular point in 2009 up to April of this year, we had an H1 virus, an H3, and influenza B viruses. And the important thing is that we always sort of are afraid of something of a 1918-like, 1957-like, 1968-like pandemic reoccurring. And so clearly, this is what this question mark really refers to. In addition to these major changes in the hemagglutinin, which you refer to as antigenic shift, okay, there are also changes within this one subtype, and that is referred to as antigenic drift. So every year, second year, third year, there's enough of a change in the hemagglutinin here so that we can get reinfected and can get disease. And if we have, for example, 6 years no infection, then the virus has moved away sufficiently so that we can get reinfected and can get disease. Yes, any question? No. So feel free to interrupt me, okay? So antigenic shift, antigenic drift, major variation in contrast to other viruses. So it's not a given that every RNA virus has to change. Yeah? Measles virus, as I said, doesn't change. Poliovirus does not change. Influenza does. And there is still no good explanation for it, okay? It's just sort of the nature of the beast. In order to sort of understand that we have difficulties in terms of having preventive measures, you have to have that in mind, namely this change in either subtypes or within a subtype, antigenic shift, antigenic drift, respectively. So this is now what the vaccine, so we do have, fortunately, in contrast to HIV, we do have vaccines for influenza. They are not perfect, but they are very good. They are underutilized, and I think we should really understand, you know, that this is something which is very positive, which we can, what we can do against influenza, and vaccines really are one of the best ways of taking care of influenza. And even though you're all young and healthy, I think it's really, there's no reason why you shouldn't have influenza vaccination. In 2008-09, so this was the fall of last year to 2009, we had three strains, one H1, one H3, and one B. And when you look at this, don't get sort of confused. This is just where the viruses are isolated. Brisbane, Florida, isolate number 4, and then the last number is always where, when it was isolated. So in 2008, 2009, the viruses which we had were sort of a year to 2 years, 3 years old already. So that you can also see that we are in the vaccine, we don't have the optimal formulation really every year. And there are a lot of reasons for that. We don't know, we have to select them much earlier because it takes some time for production. And also, many times there's a reluctance to change it because we don't know which direction it goes, okay? So this explains a little bit how, why we have actually less of an optimal vaccine against influenza. For the next season, namely 2009-2010, there was just one change here, namely the B and the A, H1 and the H3 component were actually retained. So this, I think, gives you a good feeling what is going on. We have three different seasonal influenza viruses. And in addition to this, now as we go at the end, I will tell what's happening with the swine influenza virus. Now, let me first start out to talk a little bit about this 1918 virus, because that one was really different in its virulence. And I can give you the bottom line. I mean, this virus, the 1918 virus, is much more virulent than anything else we ever had. I have at least 5,000 strains in my own laboratory in freezers, and the 1918 is by far the most virulent one in all the systems, animals, etc., which we have looked at. So why is this sort of one of the good slides, I think, which tells you that this is really a virus different from all other influenza viruses, is when we look at life expectancy in the U.S. And here we have, starting in 1918, this is both males and females. It was barely over 47 years of age in 1900. A female born in 2009 has a life expectancy now of over 80. So you can really see this is a dramatic increase in life expectancy. The reason I show it to you is there is an 11-year dip because of the pandemic of the 1918 virus. So this has nothing to do with the war, in essence. There is no World War II on here. There is no Korea. There is no Vietnam. This is all a pandemic within about a 3-4 month period, starting in November of 1918, going to February, March of 1919. And that is really what caused this dramatic loss of 11 years in the average life expectancy. So this gives you a good feeling. The numbers are, I think they're pretty good in the U.S., about 750,000 people, and worldwide in excess of 50 million. And I think those are really probably conservative numbers because we don't know what happened in China. We don't know what happened in India, et cetera. Yes, go ahead, please. Yes.
Who showed that children who were in utero during the first trimester of the influenza epidemic actually were economically disadvantaged using very robust national public health data. So that there is evidence now that women who get the flu in the first trimester of pregnancy, actually their children are in disadvantage.
Yeah, no, I would not be surprised about that. Yeah, that's sort of, yeah. Okay, now let me sort of give you sort of a little bit of from my own laboratory in terms of this 1918 virus, and this is sort of an NIH program project grant, which we, my colleague Adolfo García Sastre is actually the principal investigator of that. There are two groups at Sinai, and then there's, so these are some of these now big program project grants, which are geared to answer or to work on studying a particular question. And this is for the 1918 virus. Terry Tumpe at the Center of Disease Control, all of the, a lot of the animal original data come from David Swain's laboratory. This is USDA, United States Department of Agriculture. The sequence was obtained by Jeffrey Taubenberger when he was at the Armed Forces of Institute of Pathology. And Michael Cates from University of Washington in Seattle, he did a lot of the microarray data. And then all of the structure work was done by Ian Wilson at the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla. So this is sort of giving you a feeling that we have a big program project on this question, and we were able to use reverse genetics. That's a technology which was developed in my own lab, where we were able to make now in the laboratory, based on sequence information, a virus, and we call it reverse genetics because, as you remember, the influenza virus is an RNA virus, but in order to get to an infectious virus, we had to go first back into DNA. So what we made, actually, we made 12 different plasmids, 8 plasmids, and this is on the POL1 promoter, which are expressing the 8 different RNAs, these mini chromosomes, which I mentioned before, and then we have 4 plasmids, which are expressing the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. So this is very technical, and we put these 12 plasmids together, put them into a cell, and then as long as we get one virus particle out, we can amplify that and then study it. And that's what we actually did. And this was from a paper in 2005 where we were able to reconstruct only based on the sequence. So the virus is extinct, the 1918 virus. So there are no samples around anymore. But what was possible, the Army had wonderful pathology samples. So they had taken samples of dead soldiers and put them into formaldehyde treated and had them in paraffin blocks, And these, from these paraffin blocks, it was possible using PCR, anyone? By PCR reaction, so that the virus was all chopped up, there was nothing left, but there was enough genetic pieces of RNA were left so that with PCR it was possible to get the sequence, and then using our reverse genetics technology we were able to actually reconstruct the entire virus. And I show you a couple of very so this is now the virus which was first rescued by Terry Tumpe in the Center for Disease Control, and it's not as beautiful as the first electron micrograph I showed you, but in essence, there was no difference. It doesn't have horns, this virus, or anything. It just it's like a regular influenza virus. And one of the first things was that we wanted to know, is this virus, and particularly also for us working with it, it was important, would this virus be sensitive to the FDA-approved drugs? And the answer to that is yes, and we have two different classes of inhibitors, neuraminidase inhibitors, and M2 inhibitors. And so these are the two classes, two compounds in each case. This is a famous Tamiflu, that's a Roche drug, and Relenza is a GlaxoSmithKline drug. And so I just show you one data slide here. What we were able to show that giving, and so this is mice. So what we do is we give mice on the nose the virus, and this is all in BSL-3. We have a BSL-3 facility at Sinai. And so this is really a facility where there's a low pressure on the inside, so only air comes in but cannot come out. And one gives it to mice. One takes 8 mice in general. And then if there is just PBS, phosphate buffered saline, you can see all the mice are dead by day 10. And then if we don't challenge the mice, but just give them drug, obviously all the mice should survive. So if the drug kills the mice, that's no good. But then if we give both the drug, Tamiflu and the 1918 virus, then also we get complete protection. So that was, I think, very important in terms of just knowing that this is a virus which can be prevented by drugs, and we also showed that the virus actually, there is nothing fishy about the virus. It suppresses the immune system. We were also able to protect, make vaccines against the 1918 virus, and we were also able to show actually that the population today probably has some partial immunity against this virus because we are still in an H1 era. These H1 viruses are descendants of the 1918 virus are still with us. And on the other hand, yeah, so first I showed you, yes, antivirals work. And I didn't show you the data. Also, vaccines work. You have to trust me. But at the other end, this virus, or the other side of the coin, this virus, as I said already, is more virulent than any other virus we've ever looked at, any other human virus. And so this shows here now, these are, again, two data slides where we look at we measure now how strong is this virus. Yeah? And what we look is a mouse lethal dose 50. So we take 10 mice and we ask the question, how much virus do we need in order to kill 50% of the mice? And so this is a control virus. So that's obtained from a patient in Texas in 1991. And if one doesn't do anything to this virus isolate from humans, then we need more than 10 to the 6, more than 1 million infectious virus to kill, or as a matter of fact, we don't even get the end point here. In contrast, the Spanish flu, and does anyone know why the 1918 virus is also called Spanish flu? Anyone? So it's a very interesting historical explanation for it. Spain at the time was a neutral country. So in England, for example, in Germany, there was a censorship, a military censorship. So even though they had a lot of influenza cases, they didn't report on it. Spain was neutral at the time, and they were the only ones to report it, and therefore everyone thought only in Spain influenza exists because the New York Times wrote about it. But it had nothing to do that it either occurred there or was first found there. It just illustrates, or it just is sort of the strange situation that in Spain they could write about it, whereas in all the other countries at war, they wouldn't be allowed to write about it. And so in this case, the Spanish flu of the 1918 pandemic, only about 1,000 virus particles are needed. So we have about a three-log, a thousand-fold difference in virulence. And then if we make viruses, again, with this reverse genetics technology where we have, let's say, two genes or five genes from the 1918, we get something in between. Okay? So this lies in terms of virulence. So this is not very virulent. This is about 1,000 times more virulent. One can see that these are in between. And if we look, for example, at another model, first one was mouse. This is egg lethal dose 50. So we're looking at chick embryos. So these are young chick embryos, 11 days, 18 days, depending. And here we have, again, basically the same sort of ranking. We need more than 10 to the 7 in this case to kill these little chick embryos. In the case of the Spanish flu, the numbers are different, but again, you have here almost a six logs, almost a million-fold difference in terms of virulence. And then these viruses, 5 and 2, derived from the Spanish flu, they're in between, really, but we can't really differentiate it in this system. So this just gives you a feeling that we are dealing here with a very virulent strain. Depending on the system, it can be a million times more virulent. We need a million times less virus to kill 50% of chick embryos. Okay, so this is really sort of telling you that in the laboratory we have a strain which is much more virulent than any other human strains we have looked at. This just gives you a feeling here that we know quite a lot about it. So basically, all the proteins have been or are in the process of the 1918 virus being analyzed in terms of structure. So this is an X-ray diffraction analysis. So what you would have to think that the virus is here, the RNAs. And so this is one of the spikes, is actually one of the monomers of a trimer. So this is really the hemagglutinin sticking out, and that's a surface. So this is each one. We have about 500-600 amino acids here, and not based only on the structure, but we know that those are the antigenic sites here on the surface of, or on the apical side of the trimer. We also know this, for example, is the receptor binding site in here, which recognizes the receptor on the cell surface. And we have really been able to study this in quite detail, and we understand quite a lot in terms of these viruses. So the topic was really, what are pandemics of influenza? What's going on? I said we have the 1918, we have the 1957, we have the 1968, and then a reemergence of the H1 virus in 1977. And you may remember about 10 years ago, we had sort of this scare that there was possibly another pandemic coming. And in this case, actually, it was a virus which was highly lethal in chicken. And so this was the famous bird flu or avian influenza. And in that case, it was not an H1, not an H2, not an H3, but rather an H5. Yeah? So yet another subtype. And that one, if you are a chicken, or if you, this virus is really virulent. You know, the fatality there in a chicken flock is 80-90%. So it's really bad. You know? And the question was, can such a virus actually jump into humans? So this is this is actually from last year. So this just shows here where H5N1 viruses were found. They were found in wild birds, and those Mongolia here, Africa, obviously, then Europe, Turkey. But also in the dark brownish color here is in poultry and in wild birds, particularly in Indonesia, in obviously China, Vietnam. There were also quite a lot of outbreaks in poultry, not only found in wild birds, and also the squares here show that there were quite a lot of cases in humans. And this is really actually, I have another slide here from So we are now, the number is about 400 and about 220, 230, okay? And the winners, so to speak, are clearly Indonesia and Vietnam in a way, and it has to do that they are just more honest in terms of admitting how many cases there are, they have. Yeah. So probably the numbers are higher than that, and still there are quite a lot of deaths. I'm not sure that the death to case fatality ratio is really 50% as it's shown here, but rather it has to do really how many. So these are only serious cases in hospitalized situations, and therefore it is probably a number, the fatality ratio is probably much lower. In other words, the denominator is much, much larger. So there are many more people who have probably been infected than is the case, what this number would lead us to believe. So in addition to these H5N1 virus, so this is sort of an evolutionary relationship. What we have to do is sort of, so this is here sort of an ancestor, okay? So most of us believe in evolution, guys, okay? So there was a precursor, and then we have sort of, by change, we have gotten some of these different hemagglutinin subtypes. We have a total of actually 16 hemagglutinins. And if you sort of, so the length really reflects amino acid differences. So if you look now at, let's say, how many differences are between H7 and H15, you go from here to the common node and come back again. Whereas if you look, for example, in H5 and in H7, you have to go all the way back here, add it all up, and come back here. So in H5 and H7 are much more distantly related than, for example, in H7 and H15. Not because they are sort of drawn here next to each other, but rather you have to go back to where they have a common node. Yeah? So this sort of indicates that actually the H5 is probably only one of the viruses which can really cause a lot of problems. In the case of the chicken virus, it has been, and it still is a problem for poultry populations, particularly in Asia. In the U.S., yeah, we do not have an outbreak of H5N1 yet, okay? And it has to do with, I think, some with a different way of how we have the poultry industry. It's all in under covered situations. These are all sort of factories, really, and there is very much care that such a virus would not get into the industrial population. Yes.
Were all these cases like bird to human, or were
yeah?
Any cases
okay.
Of human to
yes.
Human?
And so that's the issue. So this would look really bad. There's almost a 50% fatality ratio. In each of these cases, it is, well, let's say 98% of all cases, one can trace back a direct contact between the chicken and the person who got sick. You know? So in this case here, or in these cases here, I believe only the large amount of virus which was inhaled, yeah, or ingested in some way or the other, caused the disease. But the virus did not have the ability to go from one person to the other person, okay? And that is the main reason why we haven't seen a pandemic in terms of the H5N1. Now, this slide is just to show you that there are in the mostly avian population, but also in chicken, in poultry, in horses, in pigs, reindeer, whales, etc., rabbits most recently, they are influenza viruses, and they have the potential to donate one of these other hemagglutinins, an H11, H9, etc., and there is the possibility that such a virus would then cause a worldwide epidemic. So that's what we have to keep in mind. Yes?
So the danger is have some kind of immunity to H1, the ones that we have not seen in a while.
Exactly, exactly. So, for example, some people, myself included, we believe actually that an H2, which was from 57 to 68, so everyone born after 1968, has never seen such a virus, yeah? But this virus is now also, well, the hemagglutinin at least, that gene is circulating in animals. So that if it comes back, that would be, I think, a prime candidate for another pandemic, for another in that population. So the oldies here, like the two of us here, we would be probably protected, but we would worry about the younger population. Okay? I didn't mean you, Sam. Okay. So, but still, with all of these 16 different subtypes which we have, yeah, there is it's very difficult to predict, yeah, whether whether it will be an H2, whether it will be an H9, H11, etc. Okay, and I think it's not easy to really put our hands around it. Clearly, before the April of this year of H1N1, I don't think any one of us in the field would have predicted that, and yet another H1 would actually make it into a virus which would be readily transmitted, because we all would have said that's probably not the right one. Yeah. So in a way, this is quite unpredictable. Okay. Now, let me sort of briefly end up with a couple of words in terms of. So the question came up already. So the H5 virus is very bad if you're a chicken, but it doesn't really readily get transmitted. And so it turned out that we had no good animal model for transmission. And what I actually developed in the last 2 years, really, before actually even the swine virus came about, was a new transmission model. And the way I found out about it was that I read a JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association paper from 1919. And they described in Camp Cody in New Mexico that they were talking about the human influenza, but they also said, quite interestingly, that there were, in connection with the experimental work, it is interesting to note that very soon after the epidemic, the 1918, so this was a 1919 JAMA paper, of influenza reached this camp, our laboratory guinea pigs housed in a small building besides the laboratory began to die. And then the next paragraph, they go on and say, then they got a second batch, and one morning one guinea pig was found dead, and within 3 weeks all of the second group of guinea pigs had died as well. And so I thought to myself, that's interesting. Maybe that sort of suggests to us that guinea pigs actually transmit the virus. And make a long story short, we have now a very efficient system to study transmission. So we have we bought a very expensive environmental chamber, so they are pretty high, where we can very well control temperature as well as humidity. And so we put here an infected animal and an uninfected next to it, and we have open cages here on two sides, and then we can study really what is going on. And so this is just one, I think, interesting piece of information. What we did is we looked at transmission now, and the way we check this is we take these animals and have the infected ones, and then have the uninfected, and do mouth washes, and then we can measure quite high titers, actually 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8 PFU. And when we do this, we can then study how is transmission at 5 degrees centigrade versus, for example, 30 degrees. And very interestingly, you know, to our surprise, it turns out that when we keep the animals at 5 degrees, we get very and low relative humidity, we get very good transmission. If we have high temperature, you know, we don't get any transmission whatsoever through the aerosol route. So this, I think, is sort of one partial explanation for the seasonality of influenza, so that in the cold season, at low humidity, we get much better transmission through the aerosol route. And that is sort of, I think, what we have in the Northern Hemisphere, in Canada, in Siberia, where it is much colder during those periods of times, and also the humidity much lower. So this is sort of a system we are now using. And so this is just to say that, yes, this is probably a partial explanation for the seasonality. And we have actually used this now to study, and I want to finish with this, with this new H1N1 swine virus which came along, and sort of tried to gauge the virulence of that virus in the laboratory. So now, as I said, in the end of April, a new virus was suddenly discovered first in Mexico and then in the U.S. And this is a virus which has an H1 again and an N1. You know? So it's really the same subtype virus as the other seasonal component which we have. We have an H1, we have an H3, and an influenza B virus. So in April, this virus came along, and actually that one was strange because it had three different origins. So we had one RNA. So remember, we have these eight RNAs again. And so one of them is from a human influenza virus, which is the PB1, polymerase basic 1. And two of them come from a North American avian virus, so RNA 1 and RNA 3. So these are from birds, from avian influenza viruses, not avian genes, but an avian influenza virus. And then five of these genes come from a swine virus, and either classic or the Eurasian one. The important one is the hemagglutinin, so this is RNA 4 here, and that's why we call this the swine virus. And so this is a very strange mix, yeah, three different origins, yeah, one from a human one, two from avian influenza viruses, and five from swine viruses. But the hemagglutinin is one which is was circulating most recently in swine viruses. Very important, however, is that the hemagglutinin of the swine virus is actually really also derived from the 1918 virus, because the 1918 virus was giving rise to our H1 viruses in 2009, but also gave rise to those swine viruses. So it turned out that in 1918, the human virus jumped into the pig population, and since that time, it has sort of circulated in pigs. Yeah? So in essence, it is a descendant of this early 1918 virus, but had been in pigs for, 80 years now. 1918 to 2009 is 81 years, okay? And so we call it only swine virus because it is an H1 which had sort of been passaged in pigs and now jumped back. And so the important things here in terms of this 2009 swine H1 influenza virus, one is that it has an H1 hemagglutinin, and also an N1 neuraminidase, but that's a less important glycoprotein. And it suggests that since you young ones, you all have H1 antibodies, okay? So there is, I can say with 99% assurance that everyone here has some antibodies against H1. Again, the older ones here have much more H1 antibodies because we have been exposed to more of these H1 N1 viruses. And so therefore, it suggests that there's at least some partial, what we call herd immunity, like herd of cattle. Yeah? It's sort of a term we use here, that we have all some elevated H1 antibodies. The other thing is, and I didn't really go into this, but there is a virulence gene which is on this PB1 gene. And all pandemic strains, the 1918, the 1957, and the 1968, has this PB1F2 gene, but not the swine virus. And we have shown, actually, that if we knock out this PB1F2 gene in the 1918 virus, we make the 1918 virus much more mellow, yeah, much milder. Yeah. So this swine virus doesn't have that gene, okay? So which I think makes this virus a little bit less sort of turbocharged, yeah, than it could be, yeah. And also, it is important to know that this is this new swine virus is, well, they call it now, they want to save the pork industry, I guess. They call it the novel H1N1 virus, so they want to get away from blaming anyone. But it's really a swine virus in terms of the hemagglutinin. It is sensitive to neuraminidase inhibitors, which is also good. So Tamiflu is quite effective against this virus. So that is sort of, I think, an important aspect of this new H1N1 virus. In the past, such a virus would not have been called a pandemic strain because we reserved the name pandemic only when the hemagglutinin changed. Remember, we called it a pandemic in H1, H2, and H3. In this case here, it is more the WHO named it, I think, June 18 or June 20th, a pandemic virus and just use the geographic definition of a pandemic, because this virus in a very brief period of time had jumped from human to human, from country to country. So in a way, this definition of pandemic depends what the WHO, if it's a geographic definition or more one of severity and including a change of the serotype. In this case, the serotype change did not take place, so it's still an H1 virus. Yeah? And so this is now just to show, again, this this transmission model which we have. So this is now here a California, this is the swine virus here, and what we just show here is the broken lines are the inoculated animals, and they show quite a lot of virus, 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8 in the throat wash. And then in the animals, uninfected animals in the cage next to it, they get infected then 2 to 4 days later, 3 days later, and you can see here they also are very well showing a virus replication. And so here 4 out of 4 exposed guinea pigs were infected. So this is very well transmissible. So this is the swine, new swine H1N1 virus. And in contrast, for example, a regular swine virus, only 1 out of 4 animals gets transmitted. This is another control of an H3N2 virus, which transmits very well. And the H5N1 virus, yeah, which we said doesn't transmit well, so that one shows 0 out of 4, okay? So we have a lot of controls. The H5N1 doesn't transmit, a regular H3N2 transmits, a regular swine virus doesn't transmit well, and the new swine virus, which has this mixture of these other genes in it, actually transmits very well. So this is sort of, move on here, and maybe I stop here and just sort of repeat again that this new swine virus has this funny derivation of the three different influenza viruses, avian, human, and swine, but it is still an H1 subtype, and it is important that we understand that we all have some immunity against these H1N1 viruses. It also doesn't have one of the virulence genes which we find in other pandemic influenza viruses, and at this point it is actually sensitive to neuraminidase drugs. And so my prediction, and again, I'm very much aware of Yogi Berra's, don't make any predictions, because it can always come differently and it's difficult for, in terms of the future, but my prediction would be that this is it behaves like a regular seasonal influenza virus, and that we would have then in November of 2009, meaning in 4 or 5 months, we would have actually a fourth influenza virus circulating, 1B, 1H3, the old H1, and the new H1. Okay, so that's sort of basically where I come down. It's possible, however, that it may also replace some of the old H1, or even replace the old H1 and the H3, and that only the new H1 will survive. So all of those are possibilities, and I think it is important to understand that we have, and I didn't show those data, but this virus really behaves like another H1 virus would behave. You know, it is just somewhat different from the currently circulating one, and that there's no reason why we can't make vaccines against such a virus. And clearly also antivirals are quite effective against it. So that's sort of in a very sort of rapid one paragraph discussion what's going on with this H1N1, the new H1N1 virus. And I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Yes.
What you said, the vaccines we put in there are usually from the seasons that circulated before. Is there any point to, you know, throw in flu strands?